Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Light Reading Podcast. My name is Phil Harvey.
And I'm Kelsey Zeiser. I'm also an editor at Light Reading.
I forgot to say I was an editor at Light Reading. Yeah. I just assume people know that, and that's very, very arrogant of me.
Who's that guy?
Yeah, right, exactly. Why is he on my podcast? I don't know what I'm doing here. That's the long and the short of it. But we do have a good interview to present today. Someone who is much better at making sense and speaking in complete sentences than I am.
Yeah, we had Jennifer Rexford with Princeton University. She recently won the IEEE Alexander Graham Bell Medal for her work in routing, and had a really interesting conversation with her about how she kind of got down that path based on her role at AT&T and some challenges that she saw along the way. And we also talked a little bit about 5G access networks and her interest there as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, it wasn't a super technical discussion, but I think hearing her kind of talk about her research on routing, on what became what we know now as software defined networking, and how making the internet, easier to manage opens up opportunities for innovation down the road. And that cooperation is what's necessary, maybe more than ever now, as we're trying to ramp up cybersecurity means to protect, more and more sophisticated attacks. So we kind of cover the gambit of the whole range of topics from what the internet used to look like and how it behaved, for providers like AT&T, how programmability in the network has solved a lot of challenges and opened up more innovation, and then where cybersecurity needs to go next as we take that programmability all the way to the edge of the network and, the radio access network and so on.
Yeah. And for anyone who wants to hear from her directly, she's speaking at the IEEE summit on May 3rd.
Yeah, that's that's in Boston, the Vision, Innovation, and Challenges Summit. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And without further ado, here's Jennifer Rexford. Jennifer Rexford, thanks so much for joining us on the Light Reading Podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to see you and great to meet you. And I guess for starters, let's introduce you to our audience. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at Princeton and also your affiliation with the IEEE.
You bet. So I'm a faculty member in the computer science department at Princeton. And for the past year, I've also been the university's provost, which is its chief academic officer. I came to Princeton in 2005 and before that worked for 9 years at AT&T, working with the folks that operate AT&T's part of the internet backbone. And I've been a member of IEEE for a number of years. My background's both in electrical engineering and computer science. They host a number of the conferences and journals that I and my students publish our work at.
Excellent. As a provost, do you mean this? I'm a little ignorant of how academic life works, but does that mean you don't have to publish anymore?
That's true. Apparently, the term provost has its roots in being a prison warden, and I'll leave you to interpret that as you will. But it basically means I'm the person that aligns the university's resources with its mission, and so I'm more focused in an administrative role these days than before.
Gotcha. Kelsey, do you want to jump in? Do you have questions queued up or do you want me to keep going?
So we wanted to congratulate you. You recently got the IEEE Alexander Graham Bell Medal. So congratulations. Mm-hmm. There.
Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about your specific work behind, achieving that award?
You bet. So it recognizes work on interdomain or internet routing and on software-defined networking. And I've always been really interested in being, an internet plumber. I think a lot about the underlying infrastructure, the pipes, and making sure that they run securely and in a performant way. And so the award is recognizing that. During my time at AT&T, I focused a lot on routing and particularly how the different parts of the internet get stitched together to be what we think of as one coherent network, when in reality, it's tens of thousands of separately administered networks. And so I've always been really interested in how the competitive cooperation between different networks somehow still works out, that that for the most part, the internet actually does sort of act like one infrastructure. Yeah. And towards the end of my time at AT&T, I became interested in ways to make routing more flexible, more programmable, so that network owners could have more say over how traffic flows in their networks. And that's why I started working on what is now known as software-defined networking, which is sort of the other aspect of the recognition.
Yeah, that. So I'm trying to, in the timeline, I might be getting this wrong, but I think your work on the what led to the Netskope tool was like pre what we called software-defined networking.
That's right. Yeah. So we started working on ways to kind of tune existing network protocols to do the bidding of the network operator, if you will. And then eventually was thinking, well, gee, why should we have to tune the protocols? Why shouldn't we just be able to tell the network exactly what we want it to do? And in a way, that's what programmable networks is doing, is trying to put network owners in control to be able to say, hey, forward packets this way and that way, rather than having some intermediary, some distributed protocol telling the devices how to behave.
What was sort of the state of things as you were doing that work? In other words, like routing has always been, well, like you said, first of all, it's for us lay people, it's a miracle the internet works at all. Like when somebody actually describes to you what's going on, you're kind of like, wow, that sounds like a mess.
Yeah.
So you just never get messages through, huh? And it's like, no, actually it works perfectly all the time, pretty much. what was this, you know, I guess what were there specific issues on the service provider side that led to sort of this desire for more programmability? Like what exactly were they seeing that they were like, you know, we need to figure out a way around this. This isn't working for us.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things that were just quite maddening, because the distributed set of protocols that were running on the network devices at AT&T, that software wasn't under AT&T's control, right? That was written by the vendors, dictated by standards. And so very simple things were really hard to do. A good example is AT&T would do planned maintenance, where they'd take a link or a router out of service for a while to do an upgrade. And that would cause transient disruptions in the network. And I remember one night working there where Sony EverQuest, I'm probably dating myself, was, you know, really popular early online video game, and tens of thousands of EverQuest players died at the same time because AT&T did maintenance on a piece of equipment and it caused this disruption.
Oh, no.
And you know, gamers can be quite aggravated.
Yeah, I'm just imagining the carnage.
They just shrugged it off and went back to watching TV,
but it was serious. It was serious.
Yeah, but
it was
quite maddening. Your hot pockets at the wall, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But what was maddening about it is we knew hours in advance we were going to take this piece of equipment offline, but there was no way to prepare the network to say, brace yourself, gracefully go to the new configuration. Instead, the network just kind of asynchronously did what it was going to do. And it was events like that that made us think, gosh, we can contort ourselves to try to prevent these things from happening. But wouldn't it be nice if we could, hey, this is our equipment. Like, why can't we, why the heck can't we just tell it what to do?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And also from a maintenance point of view, but also like when you know there's going to be weather events or outages or things like that, you know, those things, the outages themselves happen without warning, but the weather events, you can kind of always go like, okay, you know, this could go out. If it does go out, what, you know, what's our plan for that or whatever. I can see that maybe in the past it wasn't quite as eloquent of us.
Yeah. And there are other things like customers that would want to say, hey, I've got two data centers. I want half the traffic to go to one and half to go to the other. And it'd be difficult for customers to be able to express, let alone for AT&T to actually honor those requests. Mm-hmm. So there are a whole bunch of voice over IP was starting to become a bit more common. And again, the performance disruptions that could arise were more significant. Blocking denial of service attacks, who again would like to just be able to say, hey, you know, drop this traffic at this location, rather than having to kind of trick the routers into doing what you want.
Did your work influence or sort of was it using the concept of a deep packet inspection, you know, to do things like monitoring, blocking, prioritizing traffic and that sort of thing? Or was it, I'm trying to sort of picture it in the timeline. Did that kind of come, was that already around or did that kind of come after?
A little bit of both. I mean, in the backbone networks, often we're operating at too high a speed to be able to go into deep packet inspection in the parts of AT&T's network I was looking at. But if you sort of step back, some of the early work looked at making the management of the network more programmable and then the control of the network more programmable. And more recently now, there's packet level programmability using technologies like P4, so programming protocol independent packet processors and chipsets and network interface cards that support that, where now you can write code in higher level languages to do the kinds of things that, say, deep packet inspection or prioritization would be doing. So just to give you an example, some of my group's recent work parses Zoom traffic directly in the Princeton campus network and tries to figure out, hey, this Zoom call is having bad performance right now because of something in the network or mm-hmm. because someone's laptop is overloaded, the kinds of things you can analyze passively at the packet level, but only if you're able to go inside the packet and understand what the messages Zoom is sending around might be saying.
Yeah, that's what's kind of exciting about the idea of quality of service being and more programmability being built into the network is the sort of result being that some of these problems may never surface to the end user, you know, mm-hmm. like they kind of get either, or if they do, it's a very temporary thing versus like having an entire, you know, half of a show being a blocky mess because it's not streaming properly, but the network being able to correct that quickly.
Right.
That's so in important work, probably people don't see it until it's too late. Which is, you know, has its own thing, but I'm glad that the IEEE is, you know, taking the time and the effort to reward that kind of research and that kind of work. Kelsey, did you have anything, or do I? I've got another.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of circle back to, you know, as you were talking about those challenges at AT&T, can you talk a little bit about some of your key work around the routing control platform and how you address some of those challenges and keep video gamers from, you know, banging their head against the proverbial wall or actual walls?
Right. So the high level idea there, which is essentially what SDN today does, was to get a network-wide view to know how the components are connected, what the offered traffic is, and then to have direct control over how each of those network devices might forward or not forward the traffic. And one of the challenges there in the when I was at AT&T is there weren't open interfaces to the equipment to do that. Nowadays, there are more of these sort of APIs for programmability. There, we were hampered a bit. So we had to do some kind of some hacks, if you will, to essentially act like a router, to have our routing control platform act like a sort of router itself, to tell the actual routers, hey, this is the only way you can go. And we sort of pre-computed the answers we wanted them to have and kind of force-fed them using the existing standard protocols because there weren't open interfaces. So nowadays there are things like OpenFlow and P4 and so on to make that easier, which makes it a richer set of things that one can do in a programmable network than we were able to do at the time. But it did mean we were able to deploy something on AT&T's network without having to have the vendors cooperate, without having to go through new standards, without having the neighboring networks that AT&T connected to having to cooperate. And if we'd had to work through all those barriers to be able to make even the smallest bit of progress, it would have been incredibly difficult to move forward at all. So a lot of that work was around demonstrating it was possible and worthwhile to do, and particularly without requiring moving a boulder up a hill.
Right. That's always beneficial.
Yeah, indeed. So yes. It was pragmatic work, if you will. I think it had elegant aspects to it, but there was a strong dose of pragmatism built into it as well.
So when your work, kind of more currently, you're working on access or programmability in 5G networks, mm-hmm. particularly 5G access networks, what's the priority there, or what issues are you hoping to kind of dig into and solve there?
Yeah, what's exciting to me in that space is that a network owner has the potential to have programmability from top to bottom, you know, from the control plane down to the packets and from end to end, you know, from the radio to the edge server. So it's a really exciting opportunity where normally you think of, when I was at AT&T, traffic would start somewhere, hit AT&T, leave and go somewhere else. And AT&T is just a step in the journey. But in these access networks, there really is a sort of end-to-end control. And applications that have much more real-time requirements, whether it's, you know, video conferencing or virtual or augmented reality, as likewise security application, you know, self-driving car is not just a real-time application, but one where you really care about security. So it's a setting where the stakes are high, but the opportunity is really great because of that much greater control of the entire path. So that's one reason I find it interesting. And it's a space that, just like routers were when I was at AT&T, where there's a lot of closed equipment, a lot of closed standards, and a missed opportunity if we don't start to define what those interfaces should be. Things like ORAN, Open Radio Access Network, help with this. But there's a real need to make sure that we don't bake in kind of siloed solutions there, because it'll just make it very difficult for anyone to innovate, not just academics like myself, but even small companies can't innovate in a space where they have to sell a vertically integrated solution.
We've covered Open RAN quite a bit. And the issue around that, it's like everybody agrees it should exist in principle, but commercially they have a hard time making it happen because of how they're used to buying things and, you know, and how they're used to competing and that sort of thing. So there's always a push and pull about what companies are likely to do commercially versus what's probably the better long-term path in terms of, like you said, opening up things for innovation's sake, but also just for visibility, you know, for being able to, have traffic act in a more predictable way as it leaves one network and goes to another. In the 5G sort of access networks, you touched on it, but I mean, I'm kind of excited about the idea of devices like the new Apple AR headset becoming, you know, less tethered, you know, over time, and what that might unlock for people. That would necessitate a network that could make sure that connection didn't give you the spins every time you were trying to look at overlaid stuff. I have a very bad, I participated in a CES demo of a video game system that was doing, the Microsoft Kinect system back in a few years ago. We were wearing headsets on it, and there was a little bit of, there was just enough delay to make me very miserable for the rest of the show. I'll leave it there.
I think it's really important for these applications to have low latency, and that in some cases means moving the server closer to the access network, or even being in the access network, or having the access network do some prioritization or quick adaptation that might not be possible if you have to go all the way to a remote server to be able to make those adjustments. So, for example, one thing we're looking at in my group right now is, multi-party video conferencing. It would be nice if deciding what level of quality of video is sent to each of you is adjusted in the network rather than having to be done in software on a server. And there's two quality versions I might be sending of myself, and maybe one of you is on a low bandwidth connection right now and the other on a high. It should be possible. This isn't rocket science to send a smaller set of packets to the one of you that's on a lower bandwidth connection. It shouldn't have to go all the way up through the operating system of a computer and up into software. That's something that a packet forwarding device can do. It's not rocket science. If we have the right interfaces, we can make things like video conferencing or, you know, augmented reality or virtual reality scale much better and have much less jitter.
We spent the entire pandemic kind of refining what the different applications could do, you know, what, and I think people got a lot, a pretty quick education in terms of what was possible, you know, with an application versus what was something that they just couldn't control on the network.
Exactly. You know?
I was pretty amazed at how podcasting became easier after the pandemic, because everybody suddenly had the vocabulary and the awareness of what the different applications did. Since we're talking about, you know, prioritization of networks and stuff, and since this just happened, we just edited a story on this because of the vote of the net neutrality vote. Do you have any opinions on net neutrality about, it did pass along party lines, but, you know, as our story pointed out, it's basically going to go straight to court, and, you know, who knows? But I mean, what are your thoughts in general about the concept that they're trying to kind of codify into some kind of regulation?
Yeah, I sort of view net neutrality as somewhat of a pragmatic issue. If there was greater competition in the access network space, it wouldn't be as necessary because people could more easily switch, you know, from one provider to another. But most people in this country have at most two options, and some have less than two, some have less than one, which is an issue in its own right. But when there's not a lot of choice, then you end up having, you know, kind of what can sometimes be clumsy regulatory mechanisms. And I think net neutrality is a little bit clumsy because sometimes being able to differentiate traffic is important. I mean, you know, being able to differentiate between real-time interactive traffic and non-real-time is, of course, useful. So yeah. I think it's a clunky mechanism, but a pragmatic one, given the fact that there isn't true competition in many places in the access network.
Yeah, and our coverage of the digital divide, we see a lot of like, you know, well, first of all, the scenario you mentioned is exactly right. There's hardly any choice, you know, in terms of providers in the U.S. Depending on where you live, there's less choice than other places. And then like, you know, kind of on top of that, there's opportunity to both charge more for more real time, you know, high bandwidth things, and maybe charge a little less for people who just need it to do email surfing and whatever. You know, you can kind of, there seems like there's a way for providers to rate traffic differently and then price it differently to kind of make that affordability, you know, part of the digital divide less of an issue, you know, because I think that's the other thing that folks are struggling with is like, even if there is connectivity somewhere in there, you know, the choice is very narrow. And then sometimes both providers are completely out of their budget. And that's too bad because that penalizes all of us for not being able to, you know, have that person, another person connected to the network. Well, there wasn't even a question in there. I'm kind of a terrible interviewer. I just read I should probably hang this up. Kelsey, do you have one last one? Because we're coming up on about 20 minutes. We told her we'd.
I do have an actual question.
Oh, okay, good. So you're doing your job. I'll just, you know what? I'm just going to have a drink of water and just pout over here.
Yeah, go sit in the corner. You know, was wondering, just to wrap up, any other research that you're working on, that you wanted to highlight or, anything around cybersecurity? We hadn't really touched on that yet.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked about that. I mean, I think a killer app for programmable networks is the measurement of the network itself. And this, you know, something of interest to network administrators, because measurement is the first step to fixing a problem, whether it's, you know, detecting an attack. It's a lot harder to detect an attack than to know what to do once you have, right? And similarly with performance problems. As link speeds get faster and faster, doing that measurement can be quite expensive, particularly if you need to do things that are more sophisticated than just counting the traffic, where you want to look for anomalies. And so a big part of the work of my group focuses on taking advantage of these programmable network devices to do packet level analytics, with the idea of being able to detect and block cyber attacks, or to detect and mitigate performance problems. And I find that particularly exciting space. And I think it's quite necessary, because as adversaries have a distributed programmable infrastructure at their disposal, all the machines they've hacked all over the internet. And the good guys need a programmable infrastructure of their own to defend themselves. So that's something I'm particularly excited about. And programmability is important there for a second reason, because the attacks keep changing, mm-hmm. right? And we need to be able to have the defenses be deployable without waiting for the next generation of hardware to come out. We need to, you know, like the deep packet inspection question, Phil, that you asked about earlier, right? We need to be able to have new defenses and new analytics be able to be deployed as quickly as attackers move. Mm.
Yeah, especially since they all seem to be working together as a team lately, more and more.
Indeed.
You know, sharing.
Yeah, the size of the attacks is pretty stunning now. It's like it used to be just like one company, one thing, but it's like they're going after entire city networks, entire, you know, corporate entities and things like that. It's kind of interesting how that's evolved over time. Like an entire network of hospitals, for instance, as opposed to just like, you know, a few computers in one building.
Exactly.
So the antidote for that is more programmability on the security side, I guess. So that as soon as something is seen as malicious, you can tell the network, don't let this in, or
exactly. And I think programmability deep in the network as well, because unfortunately with things like denial of service attacks, if you block it really close to the receiver, you're letting that attack attack the network itself, even if you manage to drop the attack traffic before the client or the server gets it, you've wasted a lot of network resources carrying it all the way to that defense location. So another thing we're looking at is, you know, a perimeter of programmability where you can do at least some level of analytics, even in the middle of the network, so you can block things early and often, if you will.
Okay. Kelsey, see, I started and then I ended with a question that time. I was just ranting, and then I actually had a question. So
programmability works for Phil too.
Yeah, it does. I'm half Android at this point. Yes. Okay, well, let's leave it there for now. First of all, again, congratulations on the Alexander Graham Bell Medal.
Thank you,
Jennifer Rexford. Thanks so much for joining us on the Light Reading Podcast. In our show notes, we'll have links to her page at Princeton, and then also any other IEEE related stuff that we can get our mitts on between the time this is recorded and the time it goes up. But thanks again for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Have a good day.